Police Academy is your source for the no apologies, no spin truth about all things police. Discussions about why cops do what they do, avoiding speeding tickets, or just how to stay alive can all be found right here. No questions out of bounds, no topic too sensitive. This is Police Academy. Do you understand
the words that are coming out of my mouth? What we're dealing with here, Glittering Air, is a complete lack of respect for the law.
And smoking the reefer.
Call the dust pop.
We live in a society of laws.
That pop?
Yeah.
No, that's not real.
This thing of weed.
Takes one solid weekend of training to get that bag.
Ladies and gents, welcome back to the show. This is part two of my conversation with Officer Dooley. Last week we talked about a deadly force incident that he was involved with. This week we are switching gears completely and talking about race in this country and in law enforcement and how, well, let's just say Officer Dooley is in a unique position on both fronts, and you'll see what I mean in just a minute. But first, I want to read a couple reviews from iTunes, people that have gone in, rated the show, and written a review. I haven't been doing a good job of this, and maybe that's why we don't have as many reviews as I would like to. There are about 19 on there right now. I want to see about 200. So please, if you haven't done so, go rate and review the show, and I will give you a shout out on an episode. For this week, I'm going to read two. First one is from Hildy 7760. Excellent podcast on real topics. I listen to everyone and will continue to do so. I must listen for current serving and ex-law enforcement officers as well as the general public. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Hildy. Appreciate it. Brand 11. The host always seems to be well-informed and speaks very well. Oh, thanks. This is my favorite podcast now, and I would recommend this to anyone interested in law enforcement topics. Again, that was from Brand 11. Thanks, buddy, for the encouragement and just being part of the conversation here at Police Academy. And if you're listening and you haven't gotten to it yet, I understand. I listen to podcasts, and I haven't rated and reviewed all my favorites either. Shame on me. But seriously, this is one of the ways that you can really show a host that you love the show. You just have to search for the show in iTunes and then click the ratings and reviews tab, click the write a review button, and give it 5 stars, hopefully, and write a review. Pretty simple, doesn't have to be long, just a short explanation of why you love the show or how it has changed your life. That would be amazing. Thanks, guys. You rock. Enjoy the show. Hey, guys. Welcome back. This is round two with Officer Dooley of the Smorth. Smort 5th Police Department, the Fort Smith, Arkansas Police Department. Officer Dooley, thank you for joining me again.
It's good to be back.
Officer Dooley is a 20-year veteran of the department, and this episode, the last one, we talked about his deadly force incident and hopefully opened some people's eyes to the fact that that is not necessarily so much a privilege as a very heavy burden that police officers carry, a huge responsibility, holding someone's life in their hands like that. This conversation is going to be much different. There's something about Officer Dooley and the way that he has chosen to do his job and even create a family that is very unique. And so we're going to talk about that today. Stephen, would you mind just sharing kind of your family dynamic, and then we'll talk about that and move into where you work in the city.
Okay. Me and my wife have been married for almost 22 years. We had our first child in 2000. And we had our second child in 2005, which is a pretty large gap. And, it wasn't for lack of trying, I guess you could say. After we had our second child, we wanted more children, and it just wasn't working out for us. So after another 3 or 4 years of trying, we started talking about some different options, and which included adoption. And so we decided to adopt, and we adopted 2 children, and who are siblings. And they are my adopted son is about 15 months younger than my biological son. So my biological son was born in 2005, and my adopted son was born in 2006. And then his biological sister, our adopted daughter, was born in 2011. And when she came home to live with us, she was a whopping 7 months old.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And how old was your oldest at that time?
Twelve.
Okay, so you had from 12 years to 7 months.
Yeah, she's my oldest daughter is about to turn 17 at the end of this month, and so she would have been 12. She would have, I think it was her last year of elementary school or first year of grade school when all this went down. So yeah. 12. So yeah, when we adopted, we had 11. She would have been 11.
It's hard to keep track once you surpass two. It's hard to keep track anymore.
And especially when you go from two to four. I mean, when you got 2 kids and you're a married couple with 2 kids, you're playing man defense, right?
Yep, it's one on one.
So when you get to 4, I mean you have to play zone, and it's just a whole different world. But
yeah.
So there's 5.5 years difference between my oldest biological and my youngest, and I know for a fact that my biological son was almost 5 when we brought his brother and his new sister into our house. So, I can't even do the math right now. I don't know.
No, I get it. When people ask for my kids' birthdays, it takes me way too long to figure it out. Too many numbers.
Too many. Oh.
But I mean, that's having 4 kids is no small task for anyone who has kids, you understand. But what makes the Dooleys unique is, Stephen, you and your wife are white, your first 2 kids are white, and you adopted 2 black kids.
Yes, we did.
And so kind of explain what motivated you to do that.
It was kind of I joke with my wife all the time. It was my idea. You know, I was the first one to mention adoption, and my wife laughed it off. And then a couple of years later, my wife came to me and said, "Hey, I think we should adopt." And I was like, "Honey, that is a great idea." You know, once
that's the right response.
You know, but, she'll listen to this and she'll probably, make me sleep on the couch for a couple of nights. But anyway, we started looking at different options. You know, I know seems like a lot of, I hate to call it popularity because I mean, it is a good thing, but it seems like there's a lot of popularity in international adoption. Right. And I have nothing against it. We just decided that wasn't for us. I'm a police officer and my wife is a teacher. So doing private adoption and international adoption for that matter is somewhat cost prohibitive for us. We elected to pursue the foster to adopt route, which, you know, in the state of Arkansas, the Department of Human Services, Division for Child and Family Services, DHS for short, or DCFS. That's actually over the child part. You know, kids are in foster care who are open for adoption. And so, you know, we had going down that road, we had to go through months and months of paperwork and training and, you know, all the everything the state requires. We learned very quickly that if they ask for a piece of paperwork, you complete the paperwork and then you make two or three copies of it, because after you turn it in, they'll come back to you and say, we never got this piece of paperwork.
Right.
And you're like, okay, well, good. Here's a copy.
Government work at its finest.
So yeah. But that's a different story. But anyway, so, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's a long process, and through that process, you're assigned an adoption specialist, a caseworker that's basically, you know, they work for the state, but they're kind of working on your behalf. And then the children have a DHS worker and an attorney ad litem. And there's just this whole big process to all of that. But during that process, you kind of get to pick and choose. You know, a lot of people when, you know, especially people who are unable to have any children, you know, they want that experience of an infant. Mm-hmm. You know, private adoption is great for that. Going through DHS is not, and we understood that. And so we really had no intentions of adopting an infant. But we did choose, you know, we were like, okay, what are we willing? It sounds kind of almost kind of cruel in a way when you really think about it, but you know, what are you willing to accept is sometimes how DHS words it, you know, and there's this big long form, and then, you know, you got diseases and mental health issues, and you know, and you can pick and choose what you're willing to accept in your house.
Right.
So part of that process, we decided what we were okay with, what we could handle as parents, what we could handle as a family, having other kids in the house. We had to think about that. And another thing that me and my wife, you know, did some research on, asked, you know, our DHS worker, you know, where's the biggest need? What's the biggest need? And the two biggest needs were sibling groups and Black children. They don't get adopted with the frequency that White children or Hispanic children do. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that just kind of spoke to us as,
so it was,
know,
kind of a natural progression as you, interesting. So let me step back, because obviously this is a police show, and I mean, you are a police officer, but we kind of, and this is my fault, I skipped this at the beginning. You work in Fort Smith, Arkansas. It's the second largest city in the state, and yeah. You, before we started recording, we were talking, and you seem to really focus on community service aspect of your job, and you tend to work in, and currently, from my understanding, you work in the area of the city that is predominantly Black population and a rapidly growing Hispanic population.
Yes.
Okay.
Fort Smith, I want to say 2010 census numbers were about 87,000. And our African American population is right at 9%. Our Hispanic population is probably now upwards of 30%. And when I started in law enforcement 20 years ago, that was not the case. You know, that's that segment of our population, like many other areas of the country, has grown very rapidly. So yeah, so it's having grown up in the city of Fort Smith, and then, you know, to work here for 20 years, there's been some changeover in certain neighborhoods. There are neighborhoods that at one time were predominantly white that became predominantly black that have now become a pretty good mixture of, black, Hispanic, and Asian. It's been interesting to watch those neighborhoods change over, the storefronts change over, you know, from a lot of times white owned stores to Asian owned stores to Hispanic owned, you know, markets and things like that. In 20 years there's been, you know, a large growth of Hispanics, and you know, but our minority populations for the most part are contained to one area of town, like many other cities in the country. That's
right. So why do you choose to work in that area?
When I started out 20 years ago, growing up in Fort Smith, I didn't grow up in those areas. I grew up on the other side of town. Went to predominantly white grade school, junior high, and high school. I say predominantly white. I mean, it's pretty much all white back then, which has changed over to now to a certain extent. It's still predominantly white, but when I started here at the Fort Smith Police Department, once I went through my field training and went through the academy and all that good stuff, they put me out on my own, and 4 out of the 5 days a week that I worked, I was assigned to the north side of town, where obviously, like I was explaining, the population is very diverse, more so than other parts of town. And of course, as typical with many cities, it's an area that's higher in poverty, and it's an area of the city where there's more crime. And so that's where they put me. I don't know if that's because they just put rookies there because the old guys don't want to work there anymore, or vice versa. They want the rookies to get experience. I don't know what their thinking was back then, but I worked mostly north side of town, with a little less than 3 years on the department. I went to our community. I was transferred to our community policing unit, which we were bicycle officers. We rode bicycles and wore shorts and, you know, cute little jackets in the winter and rode our bicycles around. And, but we all had substations. It just so happened that my first year first few months on the bike unit, I was stationed, my substation was in a predominantly white junior high that I had attended, as a junior high student in the area that I lived. And, you know, I was okay with that. My first couple of years in patrol, I spent most of my time working the north side of town. But I was just happy to be doing community policing. After a few months into it, an opening came up at an apartment complex on the north side of town, and I took that assignment, which led to me getting a foot in the door at the junior high in that area. And eventually I had an office in the junior high. I wasn't a school resource officer, but that's where my substation ended up moving to. And so I worked a lot with the junior high and the elementary schools that fed the junior high. And again, I mean, it was, a pretty good mix back then of white, black, Hispanic, and Asian. I mean, Asian was probably the smallest population in the school, but the other three at the time were a pretty good even mix of kids. So, you know, that's where I worked. Eventually, I transferred back to patrol and became a field training officer and was assigned most of those years during my career in that stint patrol. I would say more often than not, I was assigned to the north side of town. I did work a district on the south side of town for a while that was probably more diverse than it used to be.
And you say assigned, did you have any say in these assignments, or was it just, this is where you're going?
that's funny. Of course, as a rookie, I didn't have a permanent beat because all of our veteran officers, they picked and chose what beats they wanted to work. So I was a fill-in guy. So on so-and-so's days off, I would work his car, and, you know, but those just happened to be 4 out of 5 nights or days or whatever. Right. I was working Northside cars. So then when I went to the bike unit, I was assigned to the junior high where I grew up. And then the supervisor of our bicycle unit reassigned me. There were multiple reasons behind that, but I won't get into department politics, but there were multiple reasons behind that. But I was okay with it because, like I said, that's where I'd been spent most of my patrol time, was in that same area. So I was very comfortable working that. Right. And then when I went back to patrol, it was a mixture of, you know how things work. Sometimes your supervisor is happy with you and sometimes they're not. So there were times where I got to pick and choose where I worked, which, you know, those were usually times that I picked the north side of town. And, you know, maybe I wasn't doing what I was expected to do in some way, or maybe I thought I was doing what I should be doing. And, you know, somebody thought that I need to concentrate somewhere. So yeah, it was a combination of assigned or choice.
In your mind, your eyes, looking back, was kind of what drew you to work that part of town? To what I'm gathering is you just have a heart to help people and go where people need help the most. You know, that seems to be the case with how you ended up adopting your two kids. It's like, this is the greatest need. That's where we're going to be. Is that what led you to the north side of town, or is it something else?
I think I grew to love it. I think your shows, from what the episodes I've listened to, where it's centered around honesty. So to honestly answer that question, you know, as a rookie patrolman, fresh on the streets, that's where all the action was. So, you know, that's where I wanted to be. You know, when you first become a police officer, you know, you want to be right in the middle of where all the action is, and you want to be a part of things. And so I think initially that's where I was at, but I think I grew to love North Fort Smith. And so it became more of a choice for me. I mean, if I were to choose, you know, that's where I would choose to work. My most recent stint in patrol, which has been 2.5 years now on night shift. When I first went back to night shift from admin, they put me out on the east side of town where I grew up, and, you know, working night shift out there is kind of boring, actually. You know, there's not a lot going on. Mm-hmm. I think that was a matter of my supervisors not thinking, you know, well, he just came from admin, you know, he probably needs to get his feet wet or whatever. I feel like, you know, it's like, yeah, we'll just put him out there. You know, we don't know how he's going to work, you know, being an older guy and coming back to patrol. And of course, I think they realized pretty quick that where I wanted to be and where where I did my best work. And so I work now. They slowly but surely started, you know, assigning me cars north and then beats north, and to where now every night I work north. So I mean, that's they saw my, you know, I guess my knack for being able to navigate my way through the community as far as relationships and dealing with people, and you know, supervisors, they pay attention to that stuff if they're good supervisors, and I have some really good supervisors. So but yeah, I mean, it's a love I have for the community, and it's probably grown a whole lot more in the last 5 years. Like I said, we brought two black children to live in our home and become a part of our family. And that has had a lot to do with it. Not that, I hadn't grown to love it before. I began to understand, that part of our community a lot better through the adoption process.
Right. And that was part of your original email that you sent me. You know, you mentioned that, adopting your two youngest opened your eyes to issues of racial division and tension that you'd never really noticed before, or at least been forced to confront. And I mean, that's saying something in and of itself, because you work in a very diverse area of the city already and have for quite some time. So can you give some examples? I think you have a lot of credibility in this area, because especially speaking to white men specifically, but just white people in general, you know, we get a lot of white people are just tired of being accused of being ignorant and racist and privileged, because they don't feel like that and they don't see people that way. But I think if everyone's honest with themselves, there are some things that that we're somewhat blind to because it's not been our experience. So can you kind of highlight or give examples of some of those issues that have been brought to, that you've been forced to confront after adopting your youngest two?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would say is, I mean, I totally agree. I've used the word white privilege and been scolded many times for using it. But I mean, I can honestly say that when I was a white male father of two white children, and even though I worked on the north side of town, racism wasn't an issue because I had never experienced it myself, right? I mean, it's a non-issue, you know. You don't see it. I would dare say I didn't even know what to look for, you know, because I have a lot of discussions with my white friends, and you know, and I hear a lot of times, I'll hear somebody say something like, well, of course, real racism exists, but for the most part, yada 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 yada, and that bothers me, because I'm like, so what is real racism? I mean, when you say real or true racism exists, I mean, are you talking about, you know, the minority of people out there who wear robes and hoods? Is that what you're talking about, real racism? Because I totally have a different view on what real racism is now. And actually, my very first experience was even before we chose to adopt. My daughter's best friend at school, my oldest daughter, her best friend at school was black, and we used to when they were best friends and going to school together, she would often come with us, you know, spend the night, we'd go to movies, we'd go out to eat. And I can remember walking into a movie one night, and there was very few people in the theater, and it was a kids movie. And so the other people, it was a family, a white family that was sitting down, and so it was me and my wife and my two white kids and my white daughter's black friend. And we come in and sit down, and this guy just starts, you know, kind of huffing. I can't really hear what he's saying, but finally I hear him say, "We can't sit here. Let's move," you know? And he literally gets up and moves like two or three rows up behind us. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I were just in shock. I mean, just like, did that really just happen the way we think it happened? And of course we talked to this girl's mother later on. We're like, I'm so sorry that I've never, basically our response to her was, we told her what happened and we just immediately apologized and said, "I'm so sorry you have to deal with things like that on a regular basis. We have never experienced that." And it's horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that was before we even adopted. And so we had a little bit of that. But still, I mean, still, it wasn't our problem, you know. It just wasn't. So post, you know, post adoption, I think I'll just say this: there were a lot of things that we just didn't understand and had no idea about. You pick up pretty quickly. If you pay any attention at all to your surroundings, you pick up pretty quickly when you walk into a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden all eyes are on you. And I understand that, you know, that can be justified in one way of, I mean, we're a big family. So, you know, two adults and four children walk into a restaurant and people are like, "Oh, are they going to seat them by this? I hope their kids aren't awful." You know, that's part of the stares and stuff. But, you know, some of the looks we would get, it's just like, you know, you just wanted to walk over and say, "Would you please stop staring at us and get that disgusted look off your face? Cause I'm tired of looking at it." So, you know, it's not so much, you know, people actually acting out or saying anything, but it's just this, I don't know, it's kind of like a feeling you get. You just know, you just learn to recognize it.
Right. And that, I feel like that, for me, that's where white privilege, the whole idea of that really comes into play, because as a white person, you don't have to think about that when you walk into a room. But going back to your comment about someone, you know, one of your friends or, you know, people you know, make that kind of a comment where, you know, true racism really exists, of course, but, you know, it's not very many people. It's mostly extinct now kind of conversation. I understand that perspective. And in a lot of ways, I think we've come a long ways. For me, it's semantics. What do you classify as true racism? And for me, I reserve that word for outright racism. And for me, it has to include, actual hatred for someone based on their ethnicity or race. That's kind of where it falls for me. And that's, right. I mean, that's a personal standard. And that doesn't discount any sort of prejudice, but there's a difference in the language that I personally use when I talk about that stuff. It might be, you know, a look of disgust on someone's face. It's hard to say. Maybe they are racist and that's an outward sign of it. Maybe, who knows? Maybe they have bad gas. I don't know. But for me, that's where the distinction comes in. Racism is, again, this is for me, but and I think a lot of people see it this way, and that's why they have a conversation, the ones that you were just talking about, where it's like, I feel like it is a very small minority, because in their eyes, true racism is that actual outward hatred versus just, you know, not feeling comfortable or not understanding a different culture and that those kinds of prejudices, maybe just a distaste or dislike to, for being around people that are different from them. That's certainly human nature, but you know, it doesn't necessarily rise to the level of hatred towards that other person, if that makes sense.
Well, I would add to that. When you say the word racist, I think most people automatically picture the KKK or some neo-Nazi group, some extremist group. And I get that. And I agree with that. But we also label those groups as white supremacists, right? Mm-hmm. Those are, or now we call them the alt-right or whatever you want to label them. They fundamentally believe that the white race is supreme over all other races. But I would say there's a milder form of white supremacy where, and it's really human nature. I mean, we tend to look at ourselves as better than other people, right? You know, oh, well, I'm better than so-and-so, or, you know, we make more money than the Joneses, or, you know, or morally we're better than, my brother-in-law and his family or whatever, you know, however we tend ourselves in better. So, you know, I think there's, and you know, I'll catch flack for this and I'm okay with it,
but say it. You gotta say it.
I think it's been ingrained in our society from the very foundation that whites are better than blacks, that we are the superior race. It was built into our constitution. It's built into our government. And I know I'm really not as radical as what I'm sounding right now, but I think we're fed it through the media constantly, whether it's movies or news reports or magazine ads or ads you see on TV. Whiteness is beautiful. And that's what we're fed. That's what I think if we could ever overcome that idea, that ideal, more or less, I guess you could say, I think we'd be a lot better off as a society. And it doesn't mean you're a horrible person. It really doesn't. I know a lot of really good people that would give you the shirt off their back and who do things for the community. But, you know, deep down, I think it's been ingrained into us. I had my best friend is black, and he's also my pastor. And so that's like a double bonus. But we had a discussion one time where it is so ingrained in American culture that it's ingrained the same way in black culture. He was describing to me one time, you know, if you've got a black man that successfully opens up, let's say, an insurance agency and is successful, that the black community is suspect of him and thinks that somehow he's, you know, doing people dirty or whatever to gain that advantage, and they're more likely to trust and do their business with a white insurance agent.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that fascinating. I was like, really? It's, and he's like, no, he's like, you know, that's just, I mean, he has been a great friend and has opened my eyes to a lot that I've had to deal with, you know, as I've grown the last few years and as I've tried to learn how to parent my children. Man, he's been a big help, but just opening my eyes to little things like that of, you know, it's not just, It's not just white people that see the world that way. It's everybody, because that's what we're constantly fed through the media.
You see some of, or at least I've seen some of the worst, just outright hatred for the success of a black man or woman from other blacks, because you know, the accusations that they throw at them, of bleaching and just, you know, basically being a traitor, that kind of stuff. It's terrible to see that. You know, those people have it, you know, have it hard from coming from all directions, because they can't be right when it comes to their own community, and they can't be right in the midst of a different race. It's got to be tough.
It's exactly. I mean, it's a dynamic that is just so ingrained that we don't even realize it. And then when you do realize it and you say it out loud, it just sounds crazy. But it's so true, and it's just strange to me now, I understand it better, but it's still just such a wild concept that it's like, wow. I mean, we don't even think for ourselves. We just believe whatever we're fed sometimes, and just accept that as reality. And
I want to go back just really quick to your comments about how ingrained the way that we see each other, the way that we see whites is better than blacks is in our culture, and how we see it in movies and that kind of stuff. Because I wrote a blog, and I think it made it to the podcast as well, basically talking about, and maybe you've listened to this one, that implicit racial bias is real, which is pretty much a no-brainer, I feel like, if you're honest with yourself. And the whole point of it was, it gets to kind of what you're talking about, because how much of what we see in movies and in that whites are better than blacks, you know, we see it in movies and in our just our culture in general, how much of that is a reflection of what we're actually seeing happening in our country? Does that make sense? Because when I did that blog and in that episode, what I was getting at is that we can't remove the implicit biases that our brains develop based on actual life. That will always be there. So if we really want to, for example, remove any sort of disparity in how the police in arrest rates or crime rates even would be a better starting place, then we have to remove the differences in the actual communities themselves, the differences that fall along those demographic lines, because those are in a lot of ways what create the implicit bias in the first place.
Right.
And that doesn't discount that, and in fact, it highlights our responsibility as individuals to recognize that, okay, I have this survival instinct is kind of the way I like what I like to call it, that is telling me that this person might not, I might need to like keep an eye on this person. But we need to recognize that, hey, that is built on movies, built on past experiences, maybe built on the news. And it's based on some things that are true, but also we need to recognize that that's a unique individual person. And if I want to actually love them and respect them, I've got to check my own bias.
Exactly. I mean, I don't know if everybody would agree, but your brain, I mean, I don't know, there may be somebody that might disagree, but your brain is an amazing computer and automatically does things for you to make it perform more efficiently than anything that we could ever create, right? So that's what stereotypes are. Your brain automatically does it for you. Mm-hmm. You have an experience, or you see something on the news or whatever, your brain files it and categorizes it. So the next time you see it, you know, it can be recalled faster and make decisions faster than anything from Dell or Hewlett Packard or anything else, right? I mean, right. That's what your brain does. It's a survival instinct almost to a certain extent. I mean, that's how, when you hear, because you're a police officer, and I'm sure you've, I don't know if you guys ever carried shotguns, but I mean, when you hear the pump action rack on a shotgun, you mm-hmm. know, uh-oh, that's, or the click, a hammer clicking back, or the racking of a slide. You know, if you're working night shift and you hear something like that, I mean, your survival instincts kick in because your brain's already categorized that as danger, right?
Yep.
So it's the same with people. I think the biggest problem in overcoming that, and I only say this not because I'm good at it or perfect at it, but I think we're afraid of the unknown. And, you know, we just don't know everything about or understand everything about a culture or a group of people. And so we're afraid to have conversations with them to a certain extent because we're afraid we'll say something offensive, or we're afraid they'll take something we say the wrong way, or we're afraid they'll get mad at us because they disagree with us, or but I found that when you actually overcome that fear, and it's awkward. So when you overcome that awkwardness and actually sit down and have a conversation with somebody, and not just have a conversation, because I think a lot of times we try to have conversations, especially on social media, where you're not actually talking, you're just typing, but
right. It's not a conversation if you're just trying to throw your opinions out there.
Right. You say something, and while the other person responds, you're already trying to figure out what else you're going to say to convince them that you're right.
Right.
So what I like to call that is listening with humility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, actually putting the other person first instead of yourself first and listening to their experience. You're not going to understand it. There's no way you can put yourself in their shoes and understand it. But you can listen. And you don't even have to agree, but you can listen and hear what they're saying. And actually, of course, you know, I mentioned, you know, my pastor, and his big mantra is consider others more. And that's something that my family, my wife and I, have really made our family mantra of consider others more. You know, when the boys are close in age, when they're bickering and fighting, you know, hey, if you guys would actually consider each other more, in other words, if you'd put your brother before your own selfish wants and needs and listen to what he's saying or do what he wants to do instead of just trying to get your way, you guys will get along a lot better.
Right.
And so, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, if we just set our own interests aside, set our own political views aside, set our own, you know, whatever, and just listen to what somebody else has to say, I've found more times than not that they're more than willing to the other person is more than willing to reciprocate that and listen to your point of view. Right. And I found this out the hard way because we decided to adopt black children. And when I say there's a lot of things we didn't know and didn't understand, hair is a huge thing.
That's funny. I just had a conversation with some black women friends of ours the other day about hair, and it opened my eyes to the struggles of
oh my word. It's like, you know, and And so it's like, you know, how do I keep the hair from looking nappy? you know? And of course, you know, there's a million different opinions for, you can go to this black woman or that black woman. That, oh no, use this. No, you need to use it. But I mean, we're given in skin, you know, we're giving these kids baths every day because we're good parents and we bathe our children. And so our white children, they bathe every day. And so we're giving these kids baths. And finally, this, you know, somebody pulls the size. Quit it. They don't need baths every day. Their skin doesn't have any oil, and you got to keep it lotioned, and their hair is the same way. If you wash their hair all the time, then it just stays dry and nappy looking. You got to put lotion in it and do this and that. And we're just like, oh my gosh, what have we gotten into? You know. So for us, for me and my wife, that is where the conversation started. Because, you know, I don't know about you, but it seems like when you start talking about race or, LGBT issues or whatever, you know, there's always those people that say, well, I have a gay friend, but, or I have black friends, but, and so, my wife and I realized very quickly that we did not have any black friends at all. And yes, we had black acquaintances, but we did not have any black friends because it really made us assess who are our friends. And our friends are people who come over to our house and eat meals with us, or right. We go out and eat meals with them, or we go to their house and eat meals with them. And we have conversation about all kinds of topics, and we really listen to each other. Mm-hmm. We didn't have anybody in our lives like that at all, and so it's like, okay, we need some black friends. it's hilarious. It sounds so funny.
No, but there it does sound really funny, but there's wisdom in it, because how will you ever understand that experience if you don't get close enough to someone who can share it with you?
Yeah, no, that's it exactly. And so for us, it was, especially my wife, it was just, you know, we would be out somewhere and somebody would say, oh, you know, your baby's so cute. And that was, I mentioned it earlier, we had no intention of adopting an infant, and we ended up with a 7-month-old. And so it's like, you know, that was a big conversation. Oh, she's so cute. And, you know, my wife's like, well, you know, well, she's got this bald spot back here. You know, what do I do? What do I need to do to take care of her hair? And those conversations just really opened up a lot for us, to where that led to, you know, conversations about this and that. And you know, I really had no idea, you know, what all that would lead to. And we just came to the realization that we're really good parents, and we are doing a great job, in my opinion, of raising our white kids. But now we have black kids, and I have no idea how to raise black kids. And yeah, it is different. It is very different. Just like,
and some people would, you make a statement like that and go, well, that's racist. No, it's recognizing that we're all different.
And I'm going to get back to that in a minute. My daughter and my son, biological children, are so totally different, and we don't treat them the same.
Right.
We don't parent them the same. You know, my oldest, and you know, I'm a police officer and I spank. I hope nobody gets offended by that, but my oldest, my daughter, biological daughter, you know, just the threat of a spanking, and she would just, you know, she would just snap right back into line. But my biological son, I could spank him, and then he just turn around and look at me with these dead eyes like, are you done?
Yep.
Like, that is not going to work on that one. I'm going to have to find a different way, which turned out to be because he's more tender. He's so tenderhearted that I could say, I'm so disappointed in you. And he would just melt and just be crushed.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just totally different. So it's the same, especially, and there's a whole nother level than just being a different color. I mean, these kids were taken from their mother and their father for horrible reasons, right? That's why people get their kids taken from them. And so the trauma and the stress that they've already endured, you can't parent them the same.
Right.
And I think there's a dynamic to Black culture that gets that more than I get it. I see it a lot, but I don't get it. But they have more of an understanding of that dynamic too. And so you need that help in raising your Black kids. And for the most part, from our white friends and even some of our white family, you know, it's like, oh, you're doing such a good thing. You know, this is such a good thing that you're doing. And, you know, you guys are just so wonderful for taking these kids into your home and, you know, this, that. But there's a whole different dynamic in the Black community when we get to know somebody and they're like, oh, are you fostering them? Oh, no, these are our kids. We adopted them. And, you know, and you start asking them questions and they just, I mean, they have completely accepted us for the most part with open arms and been so kind to us and helped us so much. And yeah, I'm not going to lie. I mean, as a rookie police officer 20 years ago, you know, I mentioned the fear of the unknown. I had gone to a predominantly white elementary school, junior high, and high school. Very seldom did I venture into the north side of town for anything. Although I did play peewee sports at one of the more diverse clubs in town. But, you know, I had no real experience. I mean, I had a couple of Black friends that weren't really friends. I just knew them and, you know, would talk to them when I saw them, but not anything in depth. But yeah, I mean, you know, everything that I'd seen in movies in the 90s and in documentaries and news reports, you know, what was big back then? It was, you know, Bloods and Crips, crack cocaine. And so that was my view of the Black community as a rookie police officer. So was there a level of fear there when I encountered somebody in the Black community? Of course there was. And that's how I reacted. You know, now 20 years later, and where my experience as a community policing officer in a predominantly Black area and Black school, and my experience, you know, now volunteering and coaching at the one of the more diverse boys and girls clubs and mentoring in an elementary school where I mentor, you know, other Black kids from single mother homes, you know, my understanding and my view, I mean, I don't fear people anymore like I used to who are a different color than me, because I've gained some understanding of Black culture in general by listening to them and actually, you know, trying to understand. Our favorite phrase when we're getting to know somebody is, you know, we find something to talk to them about and say, you know, well, help me understand, you know. One of our very first conversations was my Black son decided he wanted to play basketball in the first grade, and so we went to the diverse boys club and we were doing tryouts and there was this older Black lady sitting there, and you know, my wife struck up a conversation with her. She had no idea, you know, she probably thought that one of the white kids out there was ours, And, you know, she's like, now, which one is your son? And, of course, my wife pointed out my black son, and she's like, oh, that ain't right. And my wife was like, well, what do you mean it's not right? You know, we chose to love him and bring him in our home and make him a part of our family. And you know, they kind of went back and forth for a minute. It got kind of tense. And so my wife finally said, help me understand why it's not right. And of course, you know, the lady went on to say, you know, well, if I went to DHS, they wouldn't let me adopt a white kid. And my wife's like, sure they would. And of course, the lady was just laughed. She said, no, they wouldn't. And, but that beginning of that conversation with help me understand and us listening to what she had to say, her grandkid and our son ended up being on the same team. And by the end of the season, you know, it was, you know, it was hugs. And, I'm so glad that, you guys adopted him. You're great.
Right.
Great parents. But that's what it takes. It takes that awkwardness, getting over that awkwardness. You're going to be in some awkward positions when you start actually having real conversations with people.
Right.
And it's going to feel awkward, but why are we so afraid of that feeling, that awkwardness? I like embrace awkward now. I'm like, the more awkward, the better. Sometimes. You know, the better the relationships. And I have some, as a police officer, and some of the people that I encounter in the community at work and at the boys club or at the school, it makes for some awkward situations, you know, very awkward. But that's okay, you know, because I can show up on a call now and, you know, somebody will see me and they'll be like, oh, there's Dooley. I want to talk to Dooley. I don't want to talk to you. I want to talk to Dooley, you know, because they know me and they trust me and they know what I'm about and they know that I'll listen.
Right.
And they know I'll do my job if that requires making an arrest or whatever. They know that, but they know that I'll give them a fair shot and a chance to tell their side of the story. And that is huge in policing a community.
Yeah, we can all do that.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if you're a cop or not, if you can listen with humility to other people and actually look to see them and understand them, then we're all going to be a lot better off. One of the last questions I was going to ask was, you know, your thoughts on the current state of race relations in America and really getting at, you know, what can we do? And I feel like you've spent quite some time answering that just now. If you want to add anything to that, feel free. But like I said, I think you really nailed it on the head, basically, you know, getting at, are we listening to each other? And the help me understand, the second you start to get emotionally involved and want to prove the other person wrong, if you can stop yourself and think those words, help me understand, then you might actually walk away from that conversation with some new knowledge or understanding of the life that we all live, instead of, you know, accomplishing absolutely nothing by, you know, trying to prove the other person wrong.
Yeah, I that actually brought up another thought. I mean, well, the first thought is, you know, if we can just get over ourselves for a minute, you know, we make everything about us.
That's a lot to ask, though.
I know, but it's all about me and my experiences. If we can ever get over ourselves, I think we've taken a big step forward. But in the same respect, you know, you mentioned being emotionally involved. When you have a close friend and they experience a loss, whether it's a job or a loss of a family member, or even the good things, you know, maybe a new job or the birth of a baby, if they're your true friend, you're emotionally involved and you're going to be there for them no matter what it is. You know, I liken it to, last night, we had a retirement celebration, not celebration so much. But there's a guy on my troop who I've known for, he's been with us 13 years, great police officer, great field training officer, great crisis negotiator, just a great, great guy all around. Last January, almost a year ago to the date, he had a stroke, shortly after getting off duty and getting home. He almost died, and he has made an amazing recovery, but just couldn't quite make a full comeback. And he's having to take a medical retirement. And, you know, I can remember last year at about this time, just every day going up to his hospital room and just sitting with him and his wife, and or just going up there to sit with him so his wife would feel comfortable enough to actually leave and go take a shower or go get something to eat or go to work and do something she needed. I was emotionally involved. That guy's my friend. Mm-hmm. So when we say, you know, well, I have a black friend, you need to evaluate what you're saying. Would they call you if they needed something, or would you call them if you needed a favor or something like that? Or, you know, would you stand with them if they were going through a tough time? If you're not that close, then they're not a friend. They're just an acquaintance. And so I think, you know, I've said this to several people, you know, who I'm friends with on Facebook doesn't dictate who my friends are. Right. And I mean, I got friends on Facebook I don't even know.
Yeah.
I've got people that I'm really good friends with that I'm not friends with on Facebook. But I may be more emotionally involved with them than I am with anybody on Facebook. So, I mean, I think our definition of what a friend is sometimes watered down. And, you know, your true friends are those that they're going to be there for you and you're going to be there for them. And I just think there's that awkwardness prevents us from making those true friends. I mean, I've got guys that I've met in the community, black guys that, you know, we've had difficult conversations about law enforcement issues, politics, raising our kids. We've had those difficult conversations, and I can go to them for anything, and they can come to me for anything. And they'll send me text messages when, you know, they're going through something or vice versa, and just great relationships. And I didn't have that before. And so having that emotional involvement, it makes it personal. So when someone that you're that close to is hurting over, whether it's the election of a president or an issue like kneeling during the national anthem, that I don't have to agree with that, but it doesn't mean I can't stand with them. I don't have to kneel with them, but I can stand with them. And to me, that's one of the biggest problems in our society today, is that we have this either or mentality. You're either for me or you're against me.
Right.
And in reality, it doesn't have to be either or. Why can't it be both and?
Right. Exactly.
You know, I don't have to agree with you, but I can stand beside you and support you while you're dealing with this.
Right.
No matter what.
That's a very good point. Yeah, we definitely tend to look at things in a binary fashion, and it's black, white, either or, one or none. And it's just, that doesn't take into account the nuance and complexity of life and of individual people who are infinitely complex and unique. That's a really good point. And I think the overall takeaway that I really want people listening, obviously, hopefully you found something in here that that has impacted you and opened your eyes to something that you might otherwise not have been aware of. But if we can, and I understand that when we talk about this kind of stuff, it's like, you know, the Miss America pageant when they say they want world peace. It's like, well, we can't really expect people to actually do this broadly because, you know, it's just not the reality of the world we live in. But if we could, at least the people listening to this show can question their own perspective, but specific to our conversation today, if we can listen with humility and ask, help me understand. Mm. Remember that phrase, help me understand, because you may not end up agreeing, and that's fine, but if you don't give the other person, the other human being, a chance to communicate their perspective and the way they feel and, you know, what they believe in their experiences, then no one is better off. You're choosing to stick your head in the sand. Mm-hmm. Help me understand. Remember that phrase. Officer Dooley, thank you for taking the time today. You know, the last episode, you mentioned ways that people can reach out, but refresh everyone's memory on which social media platforms they can find you if they want to send you a message.
Yeah, Stephen Dooley, Stephen with a V and D-O-O-L-Y. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram, although I think my Instagram is Dooley4202. I don't know why, but that's
okay.
When I did Instagram, that's what I did. Actually, 4202 is my quote unquote badge number, so that's why I chose that number. And then at Stephen Dooley is Twitter. So if you want to reach out to me, I'm available on those platforms, and sometimes more active than others on Facebook. I've had to take some Facebook breaks recently with all the
haven't we all?
All the noise. There's a lot of noise on Facebook sometimes.
Absolutely.
I just can't deal with it.
Yep. And Stephen, the last thing I just want to say, huge thank you for, you know, taking this much time out of your day off. I mean, we've been talking for over 3 hours at this point. We split this up into two shows, but we've been talking for a long time. I just appreciate you taking the time, and I know it was hard to talk, and it's, you know, still will continue to be hard to talk about, you know, having to take another person's life. Thank you for sharing that and being open. I know that the people listening to the show will appreciate it and be better for it. And if you are listening, just, you know, obviously I'm always asking people to send stuff to me. I need the encouragement just as much as anybody else. But, you know, send a thank you to Officer Dooley on one of those social media platforms, whichever one's your preference. And just say thanks for taking the time and sharing his heart with us. It sounds like you, by all accounts, are a role model to other police officers and just other people in general. If they really want to care about making a difference and love other people, keep up the good work. Thanks for sharing.
Well, thanks for having me. And as my black friends would say, stay woke.
That is a wrap for this one, ladies and gents. Thank you for tuning in as usual. Hildy and Brand, thank you guys for your reviews. And of course, Officer Dooley, again, thank you for spending so much time speaking with me and my audience. I'm sure that they appreciate the insight that you provided. And we need a lot more guys out there and gals like you, people who are willing to see the other side. Thank you so much. If you have questions, comments, concerns, gripes, bunched up britches, or complaints about anything you just heard, you can email me at policeacademypodcast@gmail.com, and I encourage you to do so. I want to know if you have an issue or want to hear another show, or just to know that you're a live human being listening on the other end of this mic. I've seen a huge uptick in emails coming in from people, many of them who've been listening since the very beginning. So it's amazing to hear about your story and get to know you guys on the other end of this mic, to know who I'm speaking to. So I would love to hear from you. If you haven't written me anything yet, you can reach me on Twitter, on Facebook, or through email, policeacademypodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, guys. I will see you on the next one. And of course, as always, do good, be strong, fear nothing. This is Police Academy.